Saturday, February 24th, 1968.
Mr. Paulette has set up the meeting and has put a call on you, Don. First of all, Tony, what do you want to make some statement to the committee before we go to Don?
No.
As you've indicated, this is the first committee meeting and, of the subcommittee, and you'll see from the material in front of you that at least we have finally gotten to the point where some actual physical work rather than mental exercise has been performed. And I think it would be well for Don to take off, John, by telling us just what has been done, what's before you, and what he expects of you today.
All right, I think so. And Don, I'm going to kind of turn it over to you because this really is, you're the one who's been working on this. Sure, if you're involved, it's good to learn from you.
All right, thank you, Chairman. I have a few preliminary comments I'd like to make before we get into this initial draft that's before you in the blue binders. First of all, I'd like to apologize for not having copies of this out to you for examination prior to the meeting today. We had set this meeting before the work was completed or even undertaken as far as any initial draft was concerned. So we were fighting the clock just a wee bit on this thing and making multiple copies so that we had ample copies not only for the subcommittee but for the full committee and also sufficient other copies for any other interested individuals that this subcommittee feels should take a look at these early drafts that can be called upon. Now hopefully in the future we'll be able to get subsequent drafts, not only later drafts of this material, but as we move into other areas, get those out to you in ample time so you'll have an opportunity to examine them at your leisure a little bit before we sit down and try to discuss them. I'll try to compensate for that somewhat this morning by going through here and pointing out the organizational structure that we've used here and give you an opportunity to examine this as we go along. Now, this is certainly just exactly what it says on the cover. This is a preliminary draft, and what I hope we can accomplish here today is certainly at least twofold. Number one, to give us something in writing, something concrete that we can look at and discuss and see whether or not this is the general direction that we want to take insofar as the comprehensive larceny portion of the revised Oregon Code is concerned. And secondly, to see whether or not this is the right organizational method of tackling this problem. Now, I'm very optimistic that as far as the latter question is concerned, that this is going to be a workable means of cutting our teeth on this project and getting underway. Now, this first draft here, I have taken to a large extent from the revised New York Penal Law. But at the same time, in your folders, on the blue paper, you have the complete text of the Model Penal Code, larceny provisions, and the Illinois Code provisions, and so that you can get an idea of how these compare. Now, all of these codes, as well as other codes in recent years that have either just been completed or in the process, for example, such as Connecticut, has just completed its early stages. Michigan has a new code that's been drafted. Insofar as the larceny sections are concerned, they're all the same in that they all set out to do one fundamental thing, and that is to get rid of the technical distinctions that have existed in nearly all the states among the crimes of larceny and embezzlement obtaining under false pretense. And some of the codes go farther than others. Now this initial draft here, as does the New York Code, and as does the Connecticut Code, incorporates, for example, writing a bad check, and makes that a form of larceny if property is obtained as a result of writing a non-sufficient fund check. For the purpose of this initial draft, I've incorporated that, which is quite a departure from Oregon law as it always existed. But at the same time, in the approach I've taken, I feel that this will certainly do all the things that the interim committee suggested in its report in 1961, and that was to consolidate all of these crimes under one larceny statute. From the standpoint of the cases that are cited here, these are representative cases, Oregon cases, with respect to the crimes against larceny and obtaining and embezzlement. They're certainly not a complete rundown of Oregon cases, as you'll see. But what I've attempted to do at this stage is to cite enough cases to give you an idea of how the larceny provisions that do exist have been construed by the courts. Most of you are already familiar with those. But also, there are some aspects of this draft that are not completed. For example, I have not included in here, as I've mentioned in my comments, anything with respect to affirmative defenses to the prosecution for larceny. The Model Penal Code, as do the other codes, contain such affirmative defenses, and I feel that we probably would want to get into that. But at this juncture, what I've done here, I've divided this up into two basic sections. The first section concerns itself with definitions, which will be used in the larceny statute and are in here primarily not only to define the terms, but to make for a shorter statement of the substantive crime itself when we get into the larceny section. Now, I think that some of the early pages here in the binders we can go through fairly rapidly because it's background material with respect to present statutory provisions. And for example, turn to page 1A as we go through here, starting about the middle of the page, certain Oregon cases have been cited with respect to defining the terms that appear in the statute. Now, I would like to move over to page 1B, and if we can go through there, I think quickly give you the background information that we should have as we move into the draft. Now, the definitions are designed to clarify several terms used in the proposed larceny draft and to allow a briefer definition of the crime. These definitions, as is the remainder of the larceny draft, are patterned after New York revised penal law. Now, I might comment on that to this extent, that the structure is patterned after New York penal law and the substance to a great extent. However, I have borrowed also from the Model Penal Code, as well as from the suggestions made by the Connecticut Criminal Law Revision Commission, which used extensively the New York revised penal law, but made some recommendations I felt were very worthwhile. I've also borrowed here and there from the Illinois Code. Now, the preliminary draft appears, and the numbering, as you probably discovered, is at the top of the page, page 2, under larceny definitions. Now,
Mr. Chairman, pardon me for interrupting. Do you wish the members to interrupt at any point or ask questions at any time as they go along?
I would think that would be fine if Don doesn't have any objection to that. Or do you want to make your presentation first?
Oh, no. I think that we can certainly have this as informal as possible.
I think so, too.
I was going to inquire, Don, are you aware of any reason because of the Oregon's historical or traditional background, why definitions, for example, as to property should be different in this state than they are, for example, in New York, Connecticut, or Model Penal Code, or anything. Is there anything unique in Oregon's background that would suggest that we might have to have a different definition?
Well, yes. For one thing, we have a case called State versus Tausch. And now that case was an embezzlement case in which the court held that the defendant had not committed either embezzlement or larceny because the property was intangible. As we get into the definitions, I have included under the preliminary drafts of the definitions of property. Property means any article, substance, or thing of value, including money, tangible and intangible personal property. Now, the word intangible does not appear in the other drafts, the Model Penal Code, for example. But now, this was one of the shortcomings that was pointed out in the suggested statute that was proposed by the interim committee, that it didn't get to this problem. Now, I think that the other codes, for example, the Model Penal Code, I think that their definitions of property would probably cover this, but to make it clear and as definite as possible, I've included, for example, the word intangible. Now, the rest of the definition of property, as I pointed out in my comments, is broad enough, I think, to cover all of the traditional, what's traditionally been thought of as property under the Oregon Larceny Statute. Now, the definition of property has, since Deedy's code, has remained pretty much the same, except from the time it was amended to specifically cover real property, because, of course, the common law definition of larceny was concerned with personal property. But beyond that, the definition of property has not changed. Part of the statute is concerned.
Could a difference of opinion ever arise as to the definition of intangible?
Well,
I would think so.
Does this contain a definition of intangible anywhere?
In that regard, Tauscher was an OMFP case, wasn't it? Or was it not?
No, it was an embezzlement case.
All right. Well, now, we had a situation by statute under Oregon law that in the case of obtaining money by false pretenses, there has to be a false token. There has to be a tangible, tangible evidence of the false pretense. And that in chapter 130 someplace, I can't find it here.
136.
Are you endeavoring to bypass this tangible evidence of the false token by including the word intangible?
No, that's a different subject. No, that's not proof. Not what he's
dealing. No. Although, to answer your question, Senator Burns, this draft would do away with the requirement for the token.
It would do
but
away.
not in my definition of property. No. My definition of property is to get at the kind of problem that occurred in Tauscher where you had an agent who wrote a check on the principal's account without authority, and the court held that only property that is intangible and capable of being possessed can be the subject of either larceny or embezzlement. Therefore, this defendant had not committed any crime, at least either of those two crimes. I think the court also went on to say that it wasn't going to comment on whether this defendant could be prosecuted for something else, but insofar as either larceny or embezzlement, since this was an intangible thing, this did not fall within the definition of property. It had to be a tangible personal property capable of being possessed. And this is the kind of loophole that I was attempting to plug there with this definition of property. Now, and I might add that this was a suggestion which was made in a really an excellent Oregon Law Review article reviewing the Tauscher case and the proposed statute that was suggested by the interim committee to revise criminal laws, that it didn't get to the Tauscher problem because it didn't include intangible in its definition of property.
The model penal code does include intangible, but
yes. Now, their definition of property varies a little bit from the other two. Now, your definitions of the model penal code are in the first section of when you get the first blue pages. Under subsection 6, for example, this property means anything of value, including real estate, tangible and intangible personal property. Now, the New York code does not include the words tangible and intangible. They define a property means any money, personal property, real property, thing in action, evidence of debt or contract, or any article, substance, or thing of value. The Illinois Code does not include the words
credit cards do. What it shows is in action.
Something to sue somebody for. Is that right, Tony?
Yeah. Greasy, I think that's it.
A running bank.
With respect to the obtaining the problem of the token, the false token would no longer exist if you look at it as a problem. Maybe
right.
You know.
So when we speak of that as a problem of proof, what we do actually by adopting this proposed new statute, we eliminate the need for in effect repeal 136.560, wouldn't it?
Yeah, because what we do is we get over to the definitions of larceny itself, the draft saying what constitutes larceny, then we set out the type of conduct that will be considered larceny, and that will include the type of conduct which heretofore was obtaining under false pretenses.
So if we permit the district attorney, assuming that we follow this line, we permit the district attorney to prove larceny by oral representation without any tangible evidence of the fraud, right, or the taking?
Well, as far as, now, are you referring into a token or something in writing?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose if you say that you can commit larceny by obtaining property with an oral representation, yes.
Well, aren't you including in larceny any obtaining property by fraud of any kind?
Yes.
And then you can prove fraud by oral evidence.
Your token would still be the simplest, the best way of proving. Then you get into this other realm of the oral, still matter of proof.
Yeah.
Because this false token is
Well, I think of two specific cases I had involving, I'm going to belabor it, but it'll illustrate it, involving the termite peddlers in Multnomah County. In the one, guys came to this old senile 85-year-old lady, and they wanted to look under her house, and they came up and they showed her this piece of wood, which obviously was termite infected, and said, "Look, Mrs. Methuselah, your house is infested with termites. It's going to cost you $3,000 to spray it." She gave them a cashier's check for $3,000. They sprayed colored water under the house and went on. Now, we had that piece of wood. That was our false token. We prosecuted them and convicted them of obtaining money by false pretenses. Now, she testified to their representations. We introduced the false token into evidence. We got to the jury. In an identical set of circumstances, we could only show that they came and said, your house is infested with termites. It should be treated. She paid them the money. And we endeavored to prosecute them, but we didn't give them to the jury because we didn't have...
You didn't have a stick.
We didn't have a stick. That's right. Now, so putting it in perspective, we wouldn't need the stick anymore. In the second case, we'd get to the jury.
You'd get the jury. You might not get a conviction because your proof wouldn't be as strong as if you were able to show a jury the shingle or whatever happened to be. But at least under this, you would get to a jury, yes.
And of course, the rationale behind the statute that we have on the books is that the framers of the original statute were reluctant to predicate a conviction upon oral representations of old Cisco.
Well, of course, that's a decision.
Well, I'm now involved in a case where the Internal Revenue people makes a claim that certain income was income, although it was borrowed money, because the guy didn't intend to repay it when he borrowed it. And that is obtaining money by false pretenses if the government's position is accurate. And so they're permitted to go to the jury. They were, in this case, even including money that the guy borrowed from the loan sharks. $900 or 3% a month on it. And the trial court permitted the government to show monies borrowed over a period of 15 years to show a pattern. Not paying back money that he borrowed, and all of that is income and not loans to him. And I think that's going a heck of a long way.
Well, they have a pattern there, though. Isn't the whole thing a matter of proof? The whole situation, as at the present time, the philosophy of the law was that in order to prevent someone by of getting somebody convicted just because word of mouth and perhaps a misunderstanding as to what was said, because they're not positive things, they said you must have a token. If you do not, you cannot proceed beyond that. Now, if this change is made, it will do, it seems to me, what Don says. It will permit you to get to a jury. In your case, if that were one isolated transaction where he borrowed money, nothing was said about it at all, I don't know how in the hell they could ever get to a jury. How can they reach that man's mind? But where there's a course of conduct and a pattern established, although not one word was ever uttered, it isn't oral testimony, it's conduct that has been, they're using conduct then rather than the token or oral testimony to prove this mental frame of mind that he was in. It is going a little bit far, but...
It's down the Circuit Court of Appeals to see what happens. It's a new theory that the government has.
Mr. Chairman, I must apologize for not being fully prepared because I didn't realize I'd be going into depth so much, but I am disturbed. I think it's falling this way of saying. My recollection, and I'm several months away from the last time I looked at this, is one of the real dangers here is the Monday morning quarterback aspect of this kind of situation. On business, termite control or otherwise, does something of this sort. He may, in fact, have the best intent in the world. But as it works out, for some reason in the business world, goes bankrupt or can't meet his obligations, is rendered, for some reason, perhaps beyond his control, let's say, unable to carry out on the promises that he made. The problem then is jury is reached with a situation where we're proven it by oral representations. They are put in a position of guessing much way after the fact what his intent actually was at the time. And this, I think, could impose some real restrictions on the operation of businesses that we might not want to do. Now, is that the sort of thing, Mr. Spalding, that you're suggesting?
Yes, it is.
And it's a very dangerous.
Earl, I'm going to sit here today, I think, and kind of wrestle with myself because I think my mental efforts would be discussing apples and oranges. In this respect, the apple is whether we're going to require some tangible thing in, to make a prima facie case, to prove the case, a check out of wood, or some kind of a writing, a written misrepresentation. The orange is whether we're going to say that the representation must be of a past or present material fact, or whether the making of a promise, which one does not intend to keep, will be sufficient. And Don has covered that in a separate part of the material here. So we're really discussing two things. One, we're discussing the problem of proof. And second, what is the nature of the representation? May it be, must it be past or present? Or is it possible that you can use a false promise? A promise that's false in the sense that one at the time of making it does not intend to keep it. These are two distinct things, I think.
I think you're right. I'm responsible for getting us off on this.
Oh no, I think we've got to keep on wrestling with
it. Yeah, this. No. We should move on.
Could we do this? Could we get a better perspective on this thing if we could go through what the draft looks like, the definitions as well as the draft itself, and then go back over section by section and discuss it.
I think so.
Maybe some of these will be answered as we go along.
I think so.
I don't know what is the question you have in this appropriate at this stage and how to work in line with what you just suggested, please say so. And in respect to these definitions, like property means anything bad, including and so forth, I was thinking of two rules that it sometimes seems to me like the Oregon court has used.
Judge
including such things, and so on, because then you run into these rules of interpretation. Are these a limitation on the general thing? Because you've named one, have you excluded others? And I don't know. In raising this, I didn't intend to start a debate on these seven, but just a notation or a footnote for further consideration on these seven.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I think this point is well taken, but it occurs to me, not all we like sheep should follow the same people, but the New York, Michigan, Illinois, the Montana Code all use something like that. Yes. And I'm wondering, responding to Judge Sloan, now in the Michigan Code, in section 115, they've got a section on rules of construction. Now maybe in our general principles and our rules of construction,
right,
we might be able to kill the horse out there.
Right.
Michigan hasn't done so precisely. Their rule of construction is simply that the rule of a penal statute is to be strictly construed, shall not apply to this act or any of its provisions, and so on. But maybe we could kill the same one in a general proposition. And this is a plea of guilty in a Freudian sense. Don's got something done here, and I have. And I'm supposed to be working on this kind of thing, the general principles, and so we're kind of in the rock because we haven't got the general principles.
That would answer the question.
I'd like to add one more then, because I agree with your approach. And Don, I do notice a difference, which may be significant. I'm not sure about the rule of construction implied by the court, but in the old statute, first page here, the phrase is including but not limited to. On your draft, you say only including, so you remove, I think, and make it more possible for a court to be more restrictive by not having the but not limited to phrase in. Now, I don't know whether that adds anything to the conversation, but I would make an observation.
In other words, the phrase would appear, say, in the preliminary draft after including and insert the word but not limited.
I think, from my personal experience, I drafted statutes here in Illinois for 7 or 8 years before I came out here. And I think the reason why statutes continue to say including but not limited to is purely boilerplate. Statutory draftsmen are afraid to rely on what they said here. It means substance or thing of value. I think the fact is enough. Now, if the court under those in that broad phrase wants to restrict it, I think that's up to the judiciary. But the following through by then specifying, unnecessarily, I think, but as a matter of cowardice based on long years of statutory drafting. And I think that's why the Michigan Code and the Illinois Code have retained this old specificity in it, just simply because we're afraid to give up something that has many years of law.
Eastern Oregon sheepers would say, or anything else.
there have got to be some terms of art in there, certainly, that has to be something directly to the court. I think that the phrase ought to be as broad as possible and let the court then decide, rather than giving the court, or putting the court in the position of feeling that it must rely on an old, well established rule.
Yeah, well, my thinking was that the phrase in there, substance or thing of value, would be broad enough to cover any other possibilities, but I think your point is well taken.
Chairman, in those sense, I suppose, should we try to restrict the court or the legislature, but maybe the comments could say we mean to include floor sweepings and so
forth. Well, let's let Don move on to where I, from the point where I interrupted him, and then we'll.
All right, now, if we go back to page 1B, I'd like to run through these brief comments I had with respect to the definitions. We've gone through the Tauscher situation about intangible property. Subsections 3 and 4 define deprive and appropriate, and these retain the traditional distinction between larceny and other similar crimes, the intent of the actor to exercise permanent control, and or to cause permanent loss to the owner. This, of course, well-established rules, not only in this state, but in other states, have common law of arsony. Subsection 5, we get into relationships that must exist between a person and the property in order for him to be an owner. And the word owner is a word that isn't found in our existing statute. However, the phrase the property of another that appears in our present ORS 160. involvement, as in the common law definition of larceny, means ownership. For larceny purposes, uniformly held ownership of property means possession of it, and having a legally recognizable interest in property gives a person possession of it. I've cited a couple of Oregon cases on that point. And then, with respect to the rights of joint or common owners, there isn't anything to do about that. But if we can now just maybe go through the preliminary drafts of the definitions, starting on page 2. Property means any article, substance, or thing of value, including money, tangible and intangible personal property, real property, chosen in action, evidence of debt or contract. Obtain includes, but is not limited to, and there I use the phrase, I'm not using the other, but the bringing about of a transfer or purported transfer of property or of a legal interest therein, whether to the obtainer or another. And that, of course, extends the concept of larceny to include the constructive acquisition of property as well as the actual taking of it. To deprive another of property means to A, withhold it or cause it to be withheld from him permanently or for so extended a period or under such circumstances that the major portion of its economic value or benefit is lost to him, or B, dispose of the property in such manner or under such circumstances as to render it unlikely that an owner will recover such property. Appropriate, or to appropriate the property of another to oneself or to a third person means to A, exercise control over it, or to aid a third person to exercise control over it permanently or for so extended a period or under such circumstances as to acquire the major portion of its economic value or benefit, or dispose of the property for the benefit of oneself or a third person. Sub 5, owner, when property is taken, obtained, or withheld by one person from another, an owner thereof means any person who has a right to possession thereof superior to that of the taker, obtainer, or withholder. Page 2A, a person who has obtained possession of property by theft or other illegal means shall be deemed to have a right of possession superior to that of a person who takes, withholds, obtains, or withholds it from him by larceny means. In other words, prior possession would be superior. Joint or common owner of property shall not be deemed to have a right of possession thereto superior to that of any other joint or common owner thereof. In the absence of a specific agreement to the contrary, and here I digress a minute, I imagine we'll get some comments about this, but a person in lawful possession of property shall be deemed to have a right of possession superior to that of a person having only a security interest therein, even if legal title lies with the holder of the security interest pursuant to a conditional sale contract or a security agreement. Possession. Now, I don't know whether we can intelligently discuss these definitions without moving over into the draft of larceny and see how these words are used. I think perhaps we should.
I'd just like to ask one question first on page 2. Your first sentence. Is that the first thief has a higher right of possession than the second?
Yes.
Can't see it.
Well, both of them can begin with your larceny.
Yeah, yes, but with respect to each other.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one guy steals it, it's guilty, and the guy that steals it from him is also guilty.
Yeah.
Chairman, I'm embarrassed to speak up, and I'm going to shut up here pretty soon, but I think they're specific here, and maybe they're just fine. This perpetuates what I think is the present law that a partner can't steal from a partner or from a partnership. Now,
because they already owned it.
The thinking and the group about should they be perpetuated, I don't know. The theory, or sure, then once in a while you get a situation, is it always a civil matter, in other words? Or should it always be a civil matter? That's one of the next ones. In effect, is the mortgagor who leaves the county or leaves the country with the property. Statute is in effect done away with here. With a security interest proposition. I buy a car in the business contract, or whatever you call it under the UCC, I buy a car and finance it and take off to Massachusetts. I have the possession, and the person who finances it has only a security interest. And I have not committed any kind of a large crime by doing so. And this was the intention here. It will affect some other legislation. Maybe it's good, bad, or different. I don't Well, I think we're preventing from being here.
Of course, I have the phrase there in the absence of a specific agreement to the contrary. And of course, even now, I think this is generally in any of your conditions.
But how about the statute?
Prohibition. Pardon me?
Don't we have a statute with respect to
larceny by Bailey?
Yes. And that's what this would do away with, as I understand it.
Yeah, this wipes out larceny by Bailey.
Or
wipes out some specific statutes, at least, that we have to do with the... Let's move on, as Don suggested, to larceny, and then we'll come back. I can see some problems, too, but maybe it'll face it.
Now, if you'll move back beyond the second tab here into what says larceny on your second tab, page 2, text of proposed revision. Preliminary draft. Sub 1. A person commits larceny when, with an intent to deprive another of property or to appropriate the same to himself or to a third person, he wrongfully takes, obtains, or withholds such property from an owner thereof. 2. Larceny includes a wrongful taking, obtaining, or withholding of another's property with the intent prescribed in subdivision 1 of this section, committed in any of the following ways. Now, as we get into this, now, this seemed to me a good way of describing this. This goes considerably on beyond the model penal code. This is the New York approach and describes the type of conduct, I think, more specifically, to make it clear just how the crime of larceny can be committed. By conduct heretofore known as common law larceny by trespassory taking, common law larceny by trick, embezzlement, or obtaining money by false pretenses. B. By acquiring property lost, mislaid, or delivered by mistake. And then defines that further. A person who comes into control of property of another that he knows to have been lost, mislaid, or delivered under mistake as to the nature or amount of the property or the identity of the recipient commits larceny if, with intent to deprive the owner thereof, he fails to take reasonable measures to restore the property to the owner. Now, for example, supposing that a department store delivers an order to the next door neighbor of John Jones, and John has ordered this, and they deliver it to his neighbor, and the neighbor knows he's not supposed to have this, but he keeps it. This would be larceny under this statute. Right now, it would not be larceny. It might be common law fraud, or fit into one of the other statutes, but it does not fit into the larceny statute now. Now, under C, now, I put this in here with a certain amount of trepidation. I think you may be opening a can of worms here. By including the crime of issuing a bad check. And here, of course, I'm using new terminology. Bad check is not a phrase that appears now in our present statutes. But another section in the draft defines a bad check. And I want to point this out, that this is not as much of a departure as it might appear at first glance. Now, the model penal code approaches this as a larcenous type of conduct, but it's included it under their fraudulent crimes. The New York code that I borrowed this from has traditionally had a crime of issuing a bad check. But under their new code, what they have done, they've retained the crime of issuing a bad check, but by incorporating it within their larceny statute, they have said that if by issuing this bad check you obtain property, then you can be prosecuted for larceny. I don't think that it's the type of thing that is going to make or break the new larceny statute that we finally come up with, but I think it does bear some examination because I think there is a certain amount of merit in that approach. But at the same time, I'm not suggesting by this that we do away with the crime of issuing a bad check on non-sufficient drawing a check, what we call drawing a check on non-sufficient funds that we have now. But I think that's enough for that. We can discuss that as we go on. But now, Now, extortion. Now, here again, this is a radical departure. And there are some considerations that we'd have to think about by including extortion. This would be an aggravated form of larceny, and I would think that one, if we did decide to incorporate extortion into the larceny statute, that it would probably be one of the aggravated types of larceny, particularly through the threat of personal harm. But here again, the Montana Code has included this, the New York Code has included this. The Illinois Code calls it threat. It's largely there. Now, in my comments, I point out that our what we call extortion now is really compared, say, to the definition of extortion that appears in the Model Penal Code. Ours would be attempted extortion, because the gist of our crime of extortion is the threat. And whether or not anyone actually parts with property is immaterial as to whether or not the crime has been committed. It's the intent of the actor to threaten somebody to do a certain thing or to give up property. Now, if this were incorporated under the larceny statute, there would have to be a giving up of property by the owner as a result of these threats. But I would think that what we call extortion now under our present statute could be covered under the general article, say, for attempted crimes. In other words, a threat without obtaining property could be attempted extortion, for example. But I felt that there was enough merit in the Model Penal Code and the New York approach, as well as the Illinois Code, that I have included in this preliminary draft. And then I go on to define what extortion is.
Do they have number 6 in the New York Code?
Pardon me?
Number 6 on 2A, cause a strike, boycott, or other collective
group.
Yes. Does that mean?
Yes. I think we can probably, at this stage, skip through the rest of the extortion definitions. Getting down to sub E, by false promise. Now here, a person obtains property by false promise when, pursuant to a scheme to defraud, he obtains property of another by means of a representation, expressed or implied, that he or a third person will in the future engage in particular conduct. And when he does not intend to engage in such conduct, or does not believe that the third person intends to engage in such conduct. Now this gets to what Professor Archer brought up a while ago. This does away with the requirement that it has to be a representation about a past or existing fact. And we broaden considerably. Now, the balance of my draft gets into the definition of how value shall be determined. I've retained the traditional distinction between petty larceny and grand larceny, although following these other codes, I've broken grand larceny down into first, second, and third degree grand larceny, although I have not designated, as you can see, what any of these crimes would amount to, because as we go through our preliminary drafts and definitions and preliminary articles, those decisions are going to have to be made at that time as to what type of conduct is going to be criminal and to what degrees. In other words, are we going to have different degrees of felonies and different degrees of misdemeanors? So I had to leave that out. But at this stage, although I have arbitrarily upped the ante a little bit, the difference, in other words, for petty larceny, you just steal property without any proof of value, it's petty larceny. Now this might ultimately be decided by the legislature that this is going to be a misdemeanor or a petty misdemeanor or an offense or whatever terminology we might come up with. But then, if it's over $100, I'd love the ante set for $25 here. If it's over $100, then you get into grand larceny in the third degree. Or if the copy is a public record. It's been stolen. It's at large in the third degree. And if it's taken from the person of another, regardless of the value, you're retaining the distinction that exists now in our code. The statute says distinguish between stealing from the body of a person from the stealing. Or if it's obtained by extortion, it would be grand larceny in the third degree. Here again, it may be that if we decide that we want extortion to be a larceny, that it might be the feeling of everyone or a majority of those that this is a type of offense that should be more serious than grand larceny in the third degree. But for purposes of the initial draft, I've arbitrarily made it third degree. A person commits grand larceny in the second degree when he steals property and the value of the property exceeds $500. And then it becomes first degree if it's, and here if it's extortion that's committed by instilling in the victim of fear that the actor or another person will cause physical injury to some person in the future or cause damage to property. Or if it's an abuse of discretion by a public servant. Or if the value of the property exceeds $2,000. Now, this is quite a departure from what we're used to in our code. Here again, I've followed, although the dollars amount are a little more conservative than the New York amounts, because they're used to dealing with greater amounts of property, I suppose. But I think that there's a logical reason to differentiate between the values. If we're going to cut it at 75, then why not cut it at 150 or 500? And in other words, there really seems to be no logical reason for retaining this magical figure of 75. And it would seem that if a person commits a more heinous crime right now by stealing something that's worth $76, why is that as serious as someone who steals $76,000?
This is the area where we get into negotiated pleas.
Yes.
I would certainly come up with it.
Now, then receiving stolen property would be larceny. And really, although we have a separate statutory crime of receiving and concealing now, really, when it comes right down to it, that's what we're talking about to a large extent, although you don't have to prove the taking and carrying away, but you're still dealing with a larcenous type of offense. And this is what these other codes have adopted.
This is one of the areas that causes considerable trouble to the court.
The easiest kind of case to defend.
When you separate from larceny and receiving.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason or other, the prosecuting attorneys have a habit of charging people who are here as though just the thing that come to us, it would be easier to prove larceny than receive. But they charge them with receive. Now, of course, we don't know what problems the district attorney has when they submit the case. But they're constantly presenting difficult questions on this body to receive.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm sure John would probably agree with this. It's because oftentimes you feel, well, we can certainly put this person in possession. We can show he's got possession of lately stolen property, but that's all we can show. We can't prove that he took it.
Can't show the transportation.
So, but I agree. I know some of the worst cases I ever tried to get a conviction on were receiving cases. And of course, it's used now as a cop out device. Of course, we're not going to. I would assume that that receiving might be a less serious type of offense than the act of stealing. As far as being a tool to use for, really, I wasn't thinking about that as I was drafting this, but it's a possibility that this could still be a useful tool for law enforcement. That standpoint, but at the same time, because from the standpoint of the damage that's done to the owner of this property, if someone receives it and then
disposes of it, or does something other than returning it or taking reasonable efforts to return it to the owner, then certainly as far as the damage this person does, assuming this person has reason to believe that it's stolen property, it's really hard to differentiate between this kind of conduct and actually stealing from the standpoint of the social damage. Balance of on page 2, D and E, again, the bad checks. And here, this would cover the type of conduct that's now covered by our NSF statute, except that it uses some terms that the cases use that don't necessarily appear in the statute now, but attempts to define these terms. And what type of conduct is required to constitute the crime of issuing a bad check. then on page 2G, what I think is an important section, larceny services, which I feel should be separate because services certainly not normally thought of as property, and to cover what is now covered by defrauding an innkeeper, defrauding a cab driver, this type of conduct, or public services, telephone, and that type of thing. Now this is taken directly from the Model Penal Code. Not from the New York Code. Now, I suppose all I've done up to now is confuse everyone, but because we're biting off quite a lot here all at once, and I realize this, but I felt that in order to give you a perspective of the whole approach here, that certainly the basic definitions and the larceny statute, with the exception of affirmative defenses, which are not in here, should be all set out here so we can look at it as an overall picture here. Discuss it in terms of the whole idea of the statute rather than just presenting you here this morning with a section on that would cover, say, obtaining by false pretenses, and let's talk about that. I think we need to look at the whole draft in order to really be in a position to discuss it. Also, I might mention, I don't have anything in this draft with respect to what we think of as the taking and using type of offenses. Don't really quite reach the statute of larceny. But I think that we would probably want something like that in here. But I just haven't got to the point of putting that in. The Model Penal Code does cover this kind of conduct as well as the New York Code and the Illinois Code. Larcenous type of activity, but you don't have that intent to permanently deprive, which take and use an automobile, for example, but you don't really have an intent to steal it. But beyond that, I think all of these drafts, the Model Penal Code, the New York Code, and the Illinois Code, all say substantially the same thing, but they say it in slightly different manner. Without even deciding whether you like the idea of making a bad check, writing a bad check of larceny, or whether you think that extortion is the type of conduct that should be considered as larceny, I think that this type of approach will do what has been recommended by the revisers in all of the states, as well as the drafters of the Model Penal Code. And that is to get away from the arcade technical distinctions between these different types of criminal activity and say, let's call a spade, this person is stealing, whether we think of it as embezzlement or something else. And that's mainly what I've attempted to do here. that. So, Mr. Chairman, we can, certainly as far as I'm concerned, we can discuss this in the manner that the members would like to, one section at a time, or the general approach of this draft.
I think, thank you, Don. You obviously have put a tremendous amount of work into this, and I'm sure that before we make any decision, we're going to completely tear it apart. I think what we'll do is I'll ask for some general observations, and we'll just shotgun them now, and we'll discuss. We'll go on with the general observations for a while, and then maybe we'll have a brief recess a little bit later, and after that get on to specifics. But as far as I'm personally concerned, and as I view this, I'd like to hear what the committee's general observations are with respect to this approach. I've lived with this, thought about this for a long time, and not as long as some, but now I'm faced with a decision, or was faced with the dilemma of making a decision with respect to this. I can just see all kinds of problems. So I'd like to hear what the committee has to say, just generally.
Mr. Chairman, I'll start by saying the general approach in the compensation of statutes of this is great, and I believe we should follow through on this and do a complete a job on this. There are a couple of problems that come to mind right off the bat as far as my point of view. And one is there are two police problems. One is this business of larceny from the store, and the other is a bad check problem. If you increase the amount in issuing bad checks, if you increase it to, say, $100, the first plateau of $100, but the problem has always been $75, that's been a terrific problem, because you can almost write a $74.50 payroll check and do it numerous times and still use the petty larceny or a similar. That's been a nagging police problem, and a problem for the merchants. They perhaps ask for some of this. That's been alleged, of course. The other problem is that under the present statute, larceny from a store, similar premises, the store owner and the police have some immunity now. And that was just achieved in the last three or four legislatures, obtained some immunity.
The shoplifting
statute, that's right, yeah. They've obtained some immunity, and I just wonder if we should think about that.
Except
build in a lot of opposition to this if you take away some of these immunities that are now built into the law. That always have opposition to the whole idea. So we should be thinking about that. What are we doing by doing this? How can we wipe out these special interest groups who are going to say, uh-oh, we can't go for this at all because here you've taken away something that we hold pretty dear?
Any other observations? Point that you raised, you know, with respect to larceny from the store. Brings me to the point that presently there's no value upon the object that's taken from the store. In other words, you could, the first case I ever lost in circuit court was a $2.49 crowbar that a five-time loser had taken out of Sears and Roebuck and charged him with larceny from the store, which was a felony. And there's a police rationale, and there's a rationale built up in the perpetuated in the decision with respect to the public policy behind not having a dollar value on the crime, and a crime that's committed by taking something from the sacred environs of the store. The same is
from
true,
a person.
Or from a person, where we have such a terrible problem in Multnomah County with respect to purse snatchers. We have to realize, I think, that what we're doing here is we're wiping this out, are we not? And we're saying, for example, if the taking is of an amount of less than X number of dollars, no matter whether it's from a person or from a store or largely from an auto or wherever, then the crime is classified by the dollar amount. So if we follow this approach, and apparently this is the approach that's being taken in the various revision states, we're fundamentally making a policy decision that the nature of the crime is predicated by the amount that is taken.
Well,
is this not right?
Yeah, except now the draft here would make it grand larceny in the third degree as opposed to, say, petty larceny, for example, if it were taken regardless of its nature and value is taken from the person of another. That would, the distinction to make it more aggravated by stealing from the person is still retained in this draft. The aggravated stealing in a store or a building or from an auto is not in here, although, now, for example, the Michigan Code, I believe, does differentiate and make it more aggravated if it's from an auto or from a building, I believe. And perhaps this would be a way to remedy that, and that could be, I would think, simply taken care of by placing this type of stealing under, say, larceny in the third degree or second degree, and still retain the traditional distinction that this is more serious because it's of the locus of the crime, and still not require the state to prove any particular value. Now,
I've always thought in this regard that rather than giving the district attorney the discretion to charge the guy with petty larceny or cop him out at the police station or larceny in the store and try to send him to the joint, that the decision, ultimate decision with respect to the aggravation or the seriousness of it should be made by the sentencing judge. Now, maybe we're running into a constitutional problem there, I don't know. But are you saying that if we approach it from that basis, that we can leave this up to the judge?
Well, no, I'm not. I'm saying that what would happen, I would think, is a practical matter. Say if you made stealing from the person grand larceny in the third degree, and say you had a defendant who had stolen $25 from a victim, you would prosecute that person and charge him with the crime of grand larceny in the third degree.
And you'd plead it?
Yes. And that X, on or about the blank day of February, did commit the crime of grand larceny in the third degree by stealing from the person of John Doe property, or by taking the property of John Doe from his person. You would allege it, and that's what you'd prove. I don't think that you could probably get around all of the pleading problems. Now, let me say this. Now, the New York Code does have something in it, as you'll see from the draft there. The New York Code has a section with respect to procedural pleading and proof on page 4D in the blue pages in the back of your pamphlet. Their section 155.45 states that under paragraph 2, proof that the defendant engaged in any conduct constituting larceny as defined in section 15505 is sufficient. sufficient to support any indictment, information, or complaint for larceny other than charging larceny by extortion. An indictment charging larceny by extortion must be supported by proof establishing larceny by extortion. What we're saying is that except for extortion, you can just charge them with larceny and prove any of these, this type of conduct that has been described as larceny. Now, I didn't incorporate that in my draft. I felt that we might run into some difficulties here because you're placing a little bit of a hardship on the defendant when you do that. Connecticut rejected this, and I thought probably justifiably so. So that is not included in there in my draft. And also, because I think we're getting into a procedural question here, that from the standpoint of the substance of the crime of larceny might be better to leave for consideration at a later date. But I think that that when we try to consolidate our statutes, we're going to run into these questions. There's just no doubt about it. But, whether or not, now, for example, under Exhibit A, I've set out all the larceny types of offenses that appear. Now, it could be that as we go through these, that some of these things we don't want to eliminate. Now, I don't know, but it seems to me that we're going to consolidate these crimes and say larceny is larceny, that someplace along the line we're going to have to give up some of the old distinctions that have existed. Now, for example, now shoplifting, now I realize the protection that exists in that statute for the shopkeeper, and I suppose that from a long-term standpoint that's good, but as a practical matter, shoplifting is a 7-year felony, regardless of if we do away with shoplifting as a 7-year felony, I don't think that we're going to hurt law enforcement as a practical matter, because it's going to be a rare day in the state of Oregon when you see somebody being tried and convicted and sentenced as on a shoplifting felony conviction.
No, it's a misdemeanor now.
Sure,
practical matter.
Sure, it is. Or it's used as a device, an individual is charged with shoplifting, it's a little plead to petty larceny. That's where it's used. Most district attorneys would be embarrassed to go down and in a circuit court trial and charge and try a shoplifting charge for somebody for stealing a carton of cigarettes, for example.
Well, the thing I was thinking about is the immunity of the person who holds the suspect. They can hold them temporarily now with some immunity from false arrest. That's the
And this is separate, it seems to me that's a separate part of the statutory scheme that this statute wouldn't automatically shoot down.
No, I think that.
It happens to be codified in the same section now.
Yeah, it's part of 164.39.
Yeah.
This is a perfect illustration of why we're here. We have the shoplifting statute, and we have the larceny by the, from the store statute. And I'm confident that if the shoplifting statute ever went up, it would be ruled unconstitutional on state versus Kirby grounds. Because here you're given the district attorney an arbitrary exercise of discretion.
It seems to me like that question that I've been deciding, John, I wouldn't want to dispute it. It seems to me like we've got an argument, maybe it was voiced in some way.
Maybe. I don't, we never.
I wouldn't want to.
This is exactly why, you know, I think we're here to try to bring these together and to eliminate the duplicit statutes if they are. Don, I've got a question. I don't want to do all the talking, but I noticed in the Illinois, the mechanical setup as far as the Illinois is concerned, and also as far as Model Penal Code is concerned, they had these, like Section 16.1, theft, and then 16.2, theft of lost or mislaid property, theft of labor or service.
thought it would be premature to try to give any sort of a numerical division to these separate sections, except just to, for the convenience of referring to them as we go along, they've been numbered by subparagraphs. But when this finally got into statutory form, of course, I think we want to number them accordingly. But the main thing, as far as the preliminary draft is concerned, was just to get the guts of this thing before you, so you can see what it looked like. But I think certainly that there would have to be some work done on numbering.
John, in the somewhat same vein, technical, it has some substantive question. Why do you choose the word Larson instead of that?
Well, I did this, and I comment on that briefly. I use the word larceny because it's the word that's traditionally been used in the state of Oregon to designate stealing. And I think that I don't think calling it theft is going to do anything that calling it larceny won't. And I think that if we still call it larceny, it's a term that we're all familiar with, that people have used throughout the years in the state. It's a term that the lawyers in the state are comfortable with, but all we're doing is expanding the concept of larceny. Here again, now this is just an arbitrary decision on my part, although I felt that there was no reason to really start calling it theft as opposed to larceny if we accomplished what we set out to do now. New York has continued to call it larceny. The Model Penal Code calls it theft. I think Michigan calls it theft.
Well, I make an observation. I'm sure you're all aware of this. But if we are making a break with the past and the old common law distinctions that are crossing each other, but I think perhaps more appropriate that we also make a break with the common law word. And larceny, although we may attempt here, give it much broader meanings, more flexible meanings, still has, by reason of its use for so long, certain common law overtones. But theft does not have, because it was not a term of common law. It is a new term, and I think that's why some of the new statutes have been great choose to use it. I don't want to hang over the words, I guess, but my own preference would be to make a break and use it as theft. Refer to it as theft. The elements of larceny still remain, and clearly the indictment is made much more flexible. Whatever your proof shows is the crime of that.
Point there that if we're going to have something entirely new, let's put a new label on it. Yeah.
Well, theft doesn't carry with it the old baggage, the old attachments, the word larceny does. I suppose that's about its own advantage. It does have another connotation, I think, at least the word theft. It is more inclusive. Theft now includes
time limitation, I haven't.
And secondly, I think that we have to make a decision here of how many different codes we're going to look at. In other words, there are quite a number of revisions or revisions that are in the mill or just recently completed. And what I've done here pretty much is limit myself to New York and Illinois and the Model Penal Code.
One more observation, as a practical matter, would it not be easier to deal with the whole problem before the legislature and these committee hearings and with the public and with the bar by using the word theft? Because if one says larceny, then you have to say, if they're appearing before a committee, no, I don't mean common law larceny, I mean larceny under the new statute. Would it complicate presentation?
Gordon, what do you think?
Well, I agree with George, and looking at it from the point of view of what judges do, there is a great tendency to find a label and put under that label, whether we like it or not, that's a lot of what's done. And if we're talking about larceny, the courts and the people presenting cases and so on are invariably going to go back and cite cases and find larceny. Questionable case. To the extent that it would make a difference, the use of the word theft, I think would really make more of a difference than it sounds like on the surface.
That's
are either of you gentlemen familiar with the California Code?
On theft?
Yes.
I've read it, but it's been a long time since I've looked at it.
Well, I have the impression that they put in a lot of study on this and came up with what I have read, understand to be one of the best statutes.
Well, that's the reason I mentioned it, because if I'm not mistaken, theirs is operable now, and there was a Supreme Court test case on the California Consolidated Theft Statute. Is this not correct? Or
I think that's right.
Well, their theft statute's operable now, although they're in the process now of revising their whole code, including their theft statute. I think that their modern theft statute was enacted in about 1942, and was one of the early ones to really take a new look at the larceny type of crimes. But I think that.
But I know that in some of the cases we've had, for instance, like this Tosher case, and then we had one certainly shortly thereafter involving another quite similar type of thing, but slightly different facts, was the Ken Fingers fellow's name from Medford.
Kelly,
Bernard
Kelly?
No. He ran an escrow office.
Benson?
Oh, yeah.
Benson's case. We were very conscious that, for instance, if the California Code under theft by embezzlement had been involved in this case, there'd be no problem at all. And with our more various statutes on embezzlement, it created these simply little twists and facts makes a substantial difference. As we had the same case, the same thing with the woman who was running an escrow office in Portland, who got money into her possession. Presenting a very, very difficult case under our embezzlement statutes. Again, but if we had a simple theft by embezzlement statute, the problem wouldn't have been here.
Well, now, Tosher, for example, that case was when the defendant, that was reversed.
Yes.
But Bankston, that was affirmed. Right?
That was affirmed, yes. But there were slightly different facts in that.
Why don't we take a 5-minute recess and just come back and go from there. That's agreeable.
California is considering during the time that I was looking for someone, I talked to the California people, and they are considering changing their theft statute. Yes, and they're looking at New York quite favorably, because they've had problems there.
I suppose you'll never get away from problems.
No. As I recall, and this is the gist of it anyway, they felt that there were too many subtle distinctions in the California theft statute, the comprehensive one.
It seems to me that the present California statute sets up a theft statute, a grand theft, and then it says that you've got to prove either larceny, obtaining, or false pretense, but it doesn't go into enough detail about what is larceny, what is obtaining, what is false pretense. Don has solved that problem in this draft. I think I would tend to favor, as George does, using the term theft rather than larceny, from a perhaps impractical standpoint, but I think kind of practical. An awful lot of kids go into law school and get brainwashed with common law larceny, and they've got to get come up short with the practicalities of real life as much as they're dealing with after they get out. And then if you didn't use the word larceny, they might find out about what things must do. There's not a lot of baggage, as Kirk says, with losses. Maybe losses are going to change. The losses more and more are teaching a lot of penal code that attempt to get away from, but you can't avoid teaching common law largely because the lawyer doesn't understand what you're talking about.
Bruce, you've had a lot of these cases over the years. In general, what do you think of the overall approach to the court?
Good. Always have arguments about specific things, different points of view about how to say a particular thing tonight. I kind of agree. Get away from the word larceny technically would be some help in making a change in the philosophy of what we're getting there.
Well, I'm certainly not married to this word larceny. It's just that I felt as long as we're going to go ahead within the statute and say, well, this is what larceny amounts to, that it really didn't make that much difference what we call it. But I think your point is clean one, George. If we're going to make a break, let's make a clean one. And what we call it, and I don't think it's going to make that much difference. But it could be that if we're going to...
I think it would make it easier for you, appearing before the Senate and the House Judiciary Committee, to explain what you really mean, instead of having to back up and explain you don't really mean
no matter what you call it, you're going to have arguments there.
That's right.
And that the common law still is where we go for interpretations when we can't get anybody out.
I don't know, maybe it was just as good.
Where they use larceny or theft.
Maybe just writing out that word theft on the paper was too much of a shock to me. It's too much. Sort of ease into this thing a little bit.
That is true, then. In all cases,